WGTD Sports and Weather, shall we? In the NBA last night, the Bucks lost to the Pacers in Indiana, 92-89. Bulls lost to Boston, 105-89. Bucks and Bulls are both off tonight. In the NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They skate at home tonight against Colorado. Now the WGTD Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service. A winter weather advisory stays in effect till 10 a.m. Cloudy, a bit more light snow today, but no real additional accumulation, a high of 39. Right now, wind from the southeast at 4, 32 degrees in Racine, 33 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. For more, visit jackandrea.com. Support for the WGTD and the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're speaking about China today on the morning show. Actually, we're going to be speaking especially about young people in China because of a remarkably interesting new book called Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. The book is written by Zach Deichwald, who moved to China shortly after graduating from Columbia University. He has now relocated here to the United States, but speaks Mandarin fluently and still spends a considerable amount of time in China. He has many friends there and professional connections and has written a book that is just incredibly compelling. And it really helps us, shakes us loose from some of the assumptions that Westerners tend to carelessly make about the nation of China, and in particular, the simplistic, sweeping generalizations that we tend to make about that enormous country and the role that it plays in the world and what life is like for its many citizens. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Again, it's titled Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. And Zach Deichwald, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
One of the reasons I especially appreciate reading this book is because I, in my other life, teach at a local liberal arts college, and that school has quite a powerful connection with China. And in the music department where I happen to teach, we almost always have a number of young people from China who are actually studying music here. And they have been a vibrant addition to our department. But reading your book makes me realize how little I know about where they come from, and in a sense also how little I know about them. So I really appreciate this opportunity to explore your book and to understand more about this really important country. What initially drew you to that part of the world?
You know, as goofy as this sounds, it was originally science fiction. I was a big science fiction junkie growing up, and when I was deciding where to study abroad as a 20-year-old, I figured I could go to Europe and study history, or I could go to China and see where everyone was saying the future was happening. When you set it up like that, it's a kind of easy decision.
Explain the difference between, for instance, visiting Hong Kong and then crossing over into mainland China. What kind of a different experience that was?
It's almost night and day. You know, when you think culturally, at least, Hong Kong is not mainland China. It's a distinct entity. So I actually studied abroad first in Hong Kong, and I write in the book that after about a week or two, I was looking around and said, wow, this feels almost disappointingly manageable. You know, Hong Kong is such a good middle ground, famously so, between the East and West. When you go into China, it's an entirely different experience. It's far more culturally distant. And a big part of that is because it's so linguistically distant as well.
One thing that was intriguing to me is that when you first sort of made your way into mainland China, in a sense, you didn't find it revelatory. You describe it as being kind of the opposite experience. You write, seeing more of China didn't make me understand it better. It only created more mysteries to solve.
This is one of the interesting parts about China is because the linguistics and culture is so distant from what we have in the West, it's very difficult to understand. I became convinced that you couldn't understand China on a two-week trip to Shanghai, on a business trip. You couldn't understand it from a hutong in Beijing even, or a boardroom in Shanghai. So I wanted to put myself in it. I wanted to feel, you know, the taste, the energy, the heartbeat of the country. Living there, living with, you know, only Chinese roommates, my friends were all Chinese, and really maintaining a fairly strict Chinese mental diet, which means the movies I watched, the music I listened to, the conversations I have, they were all in Chinese. You sort of begin to sink into the culture far more slowly, but added to a deeper, more intimate level. You start to understand what people are excited about, what people are afraid of. My definition of fluency, this might shed a little bit of light, was that if one of my Chinese friends had a breakup or was having an emotional crisis, they could call me, complain. I would understand and be able to console them in Chinese. And then the next day, if things kicked off in North Korea, I would be able to have a conversation about nuclear deterrence as well. So being able to have those type of deeper, more nuanced conversations, that's how you really get to know and understand a people.
Hmm. I'm so glad that in the opening chapter to your book, you evoke images from those spectacular opening ceremonies for the Beijing Olympics in 2008, which you tell us was an opportunity for China to beam a new image of itself to the world, an image of immaculate synchronicity, a unified, homogeneous, tightly choreographed glide into the future, a blurring of the individuals, the spectacular beauty of the whole. China telling the world it was a balanced and unified nation striding in lockstep toward its future. But then you go on to tell us that the reality of China could not be more different. Explain the way in which China is, in fact, a drastically fragmented nation.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that you point to the Olympics because that image was being beamed to the rest of the world, but it was also being beamed to the Chinese themselves. You know, if you're a young person in China, you remember maybe the first time you saw the United States was the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. And at that point in time, China was quite poor. Your parent, I have a friend who recounts his parents were telling him at the time that, wow, that's, look at America, that's the most developed country in the world. And then to watch your country by 2008 be able to put on a performance that was known as the best performance in history to the young person in China, that was a very powerful message. Because traditionally, China is fragmented. It used to be known as a sheet of loose sand. That's what Sun Yat-sen referred to it after the abdication in 1911 of the emperor. You have so many different regions in China that all have different languages. So if I was born in, say I'm born in Wisconsin and I was trying to talk to someone from California, we would not be able to communicate. Someone from Shanghai talking to someone from Guangdong province in Shenzhen in southern China close to Hong Kong, they are not able to have a conversation in a bar if they are both speaking their local dialects. So a big part of China modernizing has been becoming a more unified nation, Putonghua. So Mandarin is a big effort in that direction, having people from all across the country being able to converse in a common language. But you have a wide wealth gap, and then even larger generation gaps, the gap between this young generation in China and the older generation in China. Hmm. There's no greater fragment in China than that one.
You tell us, in fact, that in China, it tends to think of its generations by decades.
Mm-hmm.
So those born in the 50s, those born in the 60s, those born in the 70s. And you tell us that in fact, we're talking about vast differences of attitude. And particularly for the elderly in China, they, to this day, struggle to understand China's place in the world compared to what it once was in their own formative years.
In order to contextualize just how much change has taken place, around the time that my parents were deciding whether or not to go to Woodstock, you know, I don't know if anyone listening can relate to that, but my parents talk about, you know, what were they doing that weekend? My dad decided not to go. My friends' parents in China that same year, I have friends' parents who were eating tree bark to stave off starvation. The amount China has changed in the last few decades is so far beyond our comprehension. I'll give you one more example. I'm born in 1990. In my lifetime, the per capita GDP in the United States, you know, the average living experience for most people in the United States, has improved 2.5 times, which is really remarkable for a developed country. In China, if you were born in the same year, the per capita GDP has increased 25 times. They've gone from rags to riches in their lifetime. So the older generation, 他们老一辈被称为吃苦的一代, that means the older generation in China has been known as the eat bitter generation. They were defined by their ability to withstand hardship for long periods of time at the prospect of delayed gratification. And sometimes that gratification, by the way, was not just delayed to their lifetime, but to the next generation, working hard to try to pull themselves out of poverty.
Hmm.
This young generation, you know, they're not asking themselves subsistence questions. They're not asking themselves, how do I get enough to eat? How do I provide safety for my family, for my children? They're asking themselves, who do I want to be? What do I want for myself, my family, my country? They're identity questions, which is why I call them the restless generation. When you're asking yourself identity questions, there's inevitably a restlessness that comes with trying to define who you are, what you stand for.
Hmm. Right. You tell us that some of these older Chinese still remember China being thought of as the sick man of Asia. And many still think about what was known as the century of humiliation from 1839 to 1949. And, of course, now China has emerged from that in a very emphatic way. In fact, you tell us that one of the reasons there is quite a serious obesity problem with youngsters in China is because they are, to a large extent, often raised by their own grandparents who have a very different attitude about food. Explain what I'm talking about there. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, of course. So like I mentioned, a lot of the grandparents in China, particularly if they have young grandchildren, they remember the Cultural Revolution. They remember quite literally having to find enough, you know, they weren't able to find enough to eat often. So now that China is wealthier, the idea that you're going to, you know, put your kid on a diet, that you're not going to let him have that extra cookie, it's an entirely different mindset. This older generation has a privation mindset. They remember when there wasn't enough to eat. So the way that you literally express love in China was to give someone a little bit extra food. As this older generation, they call it skip generation child rearing, because the grandparents in China often raise the child as the parents both have to work. So their way of expressing love and admiration for their child is to give them a little bit extra eat. So this single child generation is often or has been overweight. They are now trying to correct that. There's a building awareness around, you know, good health. But it's something that didn't even occur to a generation that mostly grew up without enough to eat, enough to wear.
We're speaking with Zach Dykewald about his book, Young China, how the restless generation will change their country and the world. One of the most intriguing realities and difficult realities about modern China has to do with sort of the demographics and the number of young people in China securing good education in pursuit of really good jobs, and that there simply aren't enough, that there is ferocious competition for the very best kind of jobs that a well-educated person might desire and even expect. Tell us more about the reality of the numbers when it comes to this particular matter, and kind of a perfect storm that makes this a really difficult situation for many young Chinese citizens.
Well, just to put it into context, you know, there's a big to-do about American millennials. I'm an American millennial. There's 80 million of us. In China, there are 400 million millennials, five times more than what we have in the United States, and more, actually, than the entire population of the U.S. and Canada combined. What's bizarre about the millennial population in China is that they're relatively small compared to the older generation. In China, it used to be that you had a lot of kids and very few old people. In 1950, the average life expectancy was only 36. So you didn't age, you died. Now, because of the single child policy, the one child policy, and a massive longevity revolution, now the life expectancy is around 76, and most households only have one child. So you have what's called the 4-2-1 crisis. You have four grandparents for every two parents for every one child. With that comes a lot of attention. We talk about, you know, Xiao Huangdi, little emperors. But that also means an enormous amount of pressure. Pressure to perform in school, pressure to get into a great college, pressure to get a job. And like you mentioned, Greg, the economy and the job market has not kept up with the education levels in China. The older generation, so in 1975, only 11% of the population was high school educated. This last year, China graduated 7.5 million college graduates. You know, one-third, you mentioned that you teach at a local university, one-third of all students from abroad studying in the United States are from China, one-third. It's an enormous population that's becoming increasingly educated. But the competition for every good job is so fierce that this young generation describes a childhood defined by pressure.
You really saw that playing out in some of the teaching that you did in China of some of these so-called little emperors. First of all, just explain what that term means, and then sort of physically and visually the kind of things that you observed in terms of the enormous pressure brought to bear on these youngsters from their well-meaning parents and grandparents.
Of course. So a little emperor, Xiao Huangdi, it was a term created in the 1990s to describe the single child population in China. Around 1980, the one child policy began to curb China's demographic. You know, it had a population that was growing rapidly. They felt that the land could not support, and so they were only allowed to have one child per family. People expected that to be a ticking time bomb, that this young generation was going to be spoiled rotten. One of the interesting experiences I had, like you mentioned, I was a teacher in Suzhou for the first 6 months I was there. And one class I taught was, it was a relatively upscale school, and I was teaching computer coding, believe it or not, and English to a young population, or excuse me, a young group of kids between the age of 3 and 6. So there are 6 kids in my class. They're adorable because they're 3 to 6-year-olds. And they didn't seem spoiled at all. They were actually extremely well-behaved. There was one kid named Zhang Guo in particular who I really took a liking to. But at the back of the class, behind the glass wall, there were 12 parents and 24 grandparents watching every single tap of the keyboard or twist of a microscope of this young population. They were scrutinizing every single move. After class, you know, we let class out, and I was talking to some of the parents, and all of a sudden I hear Zhang Guo, one of the younger, cuter kids, who you don't like to choose favorites, but it's hard not to. He was so curious and so determined to learn. I heard him wailing in the side of the room, and I look over, his mother and grandmother are showing him flashcards, microscope, dolphin, amoeba, all words I had taught the class earlier that day. I go over and ask, you know, what's going on? I didn't assign any homework. And his mother says to me, she says, I am preparing Jianguo for the college entrance exam. He takes it in 12 or 13 years. We're trying to give him an edge.
And
while it's a tremendous amount of attention, so these children, you know, they do get more food, they do get more resources, it's also an enormous amount of pressure.
Couple other things I want to be sure to ask you about before we are out of time. In a really intriguing chapter called How to Eat Your Parents, you talk about one matter that is often a point of obsessive focus with young adults in China, and that is securing their first apartment. Why is owning an apartment so important in China, even if it often stretches one's resources right to the edge to secure one?
So this is one of the major pressures that young men in China feel. You are not considered an eligible bachelor until you own property, until you own an apartment. It's described as anchuangan, the want for a feeling of safety and security in China, because so much has changed. And the older generation in particular remembers a time when the government would, you know, it was a communist system, so they took away and redistributed land. Having an apartment symbolizes security at a time when China feels like it's changing so fast that people want something to hold on to. But because of, I mean, if you look at the numbers, the real estate market in China is unbelievable. So the young population, the young male population in China is strapped for cash. They're trying to figure out, how do I buy an apartment but also be able to eat? So they turn into kunlaozi, they turn into parent eaters, because they have to ask their parents, who they, by the way, should be looking to take care of in traditional Chinese, in the tradition of Chinese. You know, they don't have a retirement system, they have their children. But because of the price of the apartment, an entire family, grandparents and parents, have to chip in so that their son can buy an apartment and get married. Why is that so important? Because the family unit is still the thread in the fabric, in the sort of tapestry of Chinese culture. Having a family and creating that family unit is still so essential to Chinese tradition, because they don't really have religion, but they do have family.
And you tell us that a lot of young Chinese see on television not just images from America, but even images on Chinese television that paint a picture of the most elaborate of living situations. I mean, like lives of the rich and famous, but China style, that of course is quite disconnected from what the reality is for many of these young people. In just a minute or so, can you just touch on the fifth chapter of your book, which is called Sex for Fun, The Quiet Revolution, and say a word about how the young people of China are approaching this important human matter very differently than was once the case in their homeland?
Absolutely. So China is in the middle of a sexual revolution. And I write, you know, before we imagine sort of wild sex romps, it's the difference between not having sex before marriage and having it. So the transition has become, in China, there in, I think, 1985, only 15% of the population was having sex before marriage. It was akin to sin. You know, I said earlier that China does not have religion, but it was seen as morally impure to have sex before marriage. Now over 85% of the population is having sex before marriage. And in cities, that number is even higher. And it's part of this want to enjoy the moment. There's a saying, "Jin jiao you jiu, jin jiao zui." It means today we have booze, so today we drink. It's sort of an ancient way of saying YOLO, you only live once. And this young generation says, you know, as we modernize, sex and sexuality is an essential part to our emerging identity. So it's not wild and it's not crazy hookup culture, but there is an evolving sexuality in young China.
Mm. There's also, by the way, a very interesting chapter in your book on what it is like to be young and gay in China. And, of course, you touch on all kinds of other matters as well that we do not have time to explore today. But I hope our listeners will make a point of seeking out your fascinating book again called Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World, published by St. Martin's Press. Zach Dykewald, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. Thanks for taking an interest. It's clear that you've read the content. It really means a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks again. And the time is coming up on 8:35 here on WGTD. And here is part two of today's morning show on WGTD HD. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, you're going to be hearing about the extraordinary story of Donato Tramuto, someone who is a highly regarded healthcare professional here in America. He's been the CEO of several different firms, a real mover and shaker in the healthcare sector of our economy, someone who has been an innovator, a collaborator, also someone who cares about the world and has tried to make the world a better place and all of us more well. He has written a very, very intriguing book, which is part memoir, called Life's Bulldozer Moments: How Adversity Leads to Success in Life and Business. Mm-hmm. In it, he spells out some of the really extraordinary difficulties that he has faced in his own life in terms of his health with profound hearing loss, and also some really painful losses of other kinds as well, suffered over and over again. And he has learned some very powerful life lessons, which have served him extremely well in the exceptionally successful professional career that he has enjoyed. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with him about his book, again called Life's Bulldozer Moments: How Adversity Leads to Success in Life and Business, which he co-wrote with Chris Black. It's published by Hamilton Books, which is an imprint of Roman and Littlefield. Donato Tramuto, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's really an honor and pleasure to be here today.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. We might as well get right to it. That is sort of right to the negative, if you will, but only because out of those negatives come some really potent positives. I think it's important for our listeners to understand just the kind of adversity that you experienced as a young person growing up, more adversity than I would say was your fair share. Spell out some of the most significant adversity that was part of your early life and that has profound consequences for you to this very day.
Thank you very much, Greg. And first, I want to just say is that all of us have stories, and I want to just make sure I preface this to say that my story is simply a story, and it's no better, no worse than anyone else. But I felt a innate need to share with others the many bulldozer moments that I had in my life, which started at the age of 8 with the loss of my hearing. And for 10 years following that loss, I was bullied and made fun of. I failed the fifth grade and was rejected from every single college that I applied to once my hearing had been restored at age 17. There was a lot of catch-up that I had to do in terms of academics, as well as I had a severe speech impediment. But during that time and in my life, I've had a succession of other tragedies that rocked my world, the tragic loss of my brother in an auto accident, the loss of my sister-in-law in childbirth due to a medication error. What culminated all of these other tragedies was the loss of my two friends and their three-year-old on 9/11. They lost their lives. The second plane hit the South Tower. I was scheduled to be on that flight, changed my mind the day before because I had a toothache. And so what I tried to highlight was that one looks at your life in the current chapter, and they may see that as being very successful, and there's no connection to all of the other events that have happened in your life that has created for you who you are, what you are, and what you believe in. And I've been fortunate. It's not about the bulldozer moment, severe as it may be. It's really about what you do in terms of how you get back up and you get back into the arena. And so for me, I just felt a sense of responsibility to share that story with others.
Hmm. I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity to speak for a moment about one of those losses that you mentioned that was especially painful for you, and that was when your older brother, I think his name was Gerald, was killed in a car accident. I want you to explain to your listeners a little bit about your brother, why he was so important to you, and what kind of a loss his unexpected and tragic death represented for you as a young 10 or 11-year-old.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if you put it in the context, I lost my hearing in 1964. And again, I had highlighted to you that I had failed the fifth grade. And my brother Jerry especially was a remarkable, compassionate, very athletic, highly successful individual in his own right. And he came for me. And I think that when you have a bulldozer moment, I think what's important is that you really connect with others who have an ability to be compassionate, who have an ability to really be your kind of tenacious link. And my brother Jerry was that tenacious link. He was that compassionate individual who I relied on. And so to wake up one morning and to have been delivered the news that this brother, the person who really was there for you, was now taken away. And keep in mind that I was impaired with a severe hearing loss. And so the inwardness of how I had to deal with that was quite painful. And I did not want to share that with my parents, who were obviously going through a very, very significant time with the loss of a son. And so for me, I think that several things happened that year. It was also the year that Senator Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And I think during those moments when I was bullied and denied the right to be heard, for me, I entered into an intellectual curiosity that was fueled by the writings of Robert Kennedy, you know, 6 months after my brother was killed. And I think for me, reading about Robert Kennedy and how he handled the loss of his own brother, President Kennedy, in 1963, that was such an enormous loss for him. Not just in terms of losing his brother, but losing, if you will, such great professional stature as Attorney General, really following his transformation really helped me to transform. And I think in many respects, had I not had that that linkage or that that ability to study and understand how he was able to transform his life and really begin to define other areas of passionate commitments that really shaped his life. I think that's really what shaped my life. And so, yes, I lost my brother, like Senator, you know, Kennedy. Yes, it was painful. Yes, it was an enormous breed in my life. However, I think that it did an enormous amount of good for me in terms of how I recovered and how I defined my life to be even more meaningful. So that's what a bulldozer moment, I think, in many respects provides.
One of my favorite moments, as you described this painful moment in your life, this painful loss, was when you talk about a note that you, as an 11-year-old boy, wrote and then set on the pillow of your mom or your dad, a little message of hope for them, which also says a lot about what you were able to take from this moment. Tell our listeners about that note, which as a young boy you wrote to your own parents to try to comfort them.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you were asking that question, I have to be honest with you, my eyes started to tear up. I remember that moment. And I think that a bulldozer moment for all of us, and me particularly, it guides me to what Tennyson once said, and that is, quote, "We faintly trust the larger hope," end of quote. And I think that that's what I really wanted to be for my parents. I could not particularly hear. However, I could see the pain, and I could feel their pain. And I could have, you know, just focused on my own loss and wallowed in my own grief. And yet I knew that I could be and wanted to be a support for my parents. And you're absolutely correct. You highlighted it correctly, is that my parents a note. I placed it on their pillow, And I remember to this day, it's been 50 years this year that I lost my brother. And I remember distinctly my father, who was a tough, you know, Italian, you know, father, you know, but with lots of love. I knew my father had some, but I remember him walking into my room and just hugging me and, you know, tearing up and thanking me, you know, for providing that sense of encouragement. And I, in many respects, even though I had a struggle that I was going through, I became, in many respects, the force, almost similar to, you know, Senator Kennedy. I became the force for my family and the force that really kept the optimism in play. And it has served me well 50 years later. I think that that's been one of the gifts in one of my brands is encouraging optimism amidst such great loss.
Hmm. And of course, one of the other losses that you mentioned, which was the loss of your sister-in-law, a beloved part of your family, has a lot to do with how you have devoted so much of your life since to the healthcare industry. Explain the circumstances of her tragic death and the catalyst that it has been for you in terms of the work that you have done in subsequent years.
It's a very, very good question. I think to really answer it, I would have to share with you that my sister-in-law was a speech pathologist. And so during the time that I had lost my hearing, I suffered an enormous amount of speech impediment, and my fluency was not at all where it should have been. When my hearing was partially restored in 1972, my sister-in-law became such a catalyst for me in terms of getting me to the local college where she was a professor and practicing my speech and taping and recording. I couldn't pronounce my R's. I couldn't pronounce my W's. And she was such an enormous catalyst to helping me perfect, if you will, what was a significant challenge. Then on July 21st, 1972, Rosemary, we called her Ayers because she wasn't fond of her name, Rosemary. She was expecting her second child, and we were all happy, and she was whisked to the hospital. It was early afternoon. And at 7 o'clock that evening, my brother was outside of our home with his girl son and screaming and sharing the news that she had lost her life in childbirth, which is something, as you know, in the industrialized world just doesn't happen. And she died because of a medication error. And, you know, not only, you know, in that moment had I lost enormous, now I've lost two, you know, my brother and my sister-in-law, who coincidentally both, you know, were born the same year. I lost this connection of somebody who was so devoted to ensuring that my speech would be improved. And so first, I would not give up on that. And you could hopefully detect in, you know, my voice right now that I was able to improve my speech and attribute to Rosemary. However, I had said to myself that if I ever muster up, if you will, the academic excellence that had been deteriorated as a result of my hearing loss, that if I could muster up that ability to academically improve, that I would devote myself to the industry and profession of healthcare, specifically to improving, if you will, a safer environment for all consumers of healthcare, so that what happened to my sister-in-law would never, ever happen again. And so I have devoted my my career, and I've started several companies. I have been very focused on data and how you deliver that data to healthcare professionals. I don't think sometimes we realize the severity of medication errors, and you won't realize it until you put it into an illustrative example. 200,000 people die each year because of a medication error. That is equivalent to the unsafe landing of 10 jumbo jets each week. Now, let me tell you, if we had each week the unsafe landing of 10 jumbo jets, I think the airline industry would be in great trouble. And so we have to put it into the context of examples that help to get others to realize that medication errors are a significant issue, even 4-6 years later from the time that my sister-in-law lost her life. And so that has been my career. That has been my passion. And that has been my professional why these days.
Mm. We're speaking with Donato Tramuto about his book, Life's Bulldozer Moments, How Adversity Leads to Success in Life and Business. Much of your book explores some of the work that you have done and some of these life lessons that you have learned from the adversity that you have experienced. I want to be sure to ask you about a couple of matters that are really important, especially in terms of how you see the healthcare industry and the way in which that you have tried to work within it. One of the deficiencies that you have seen is that our healthcare system, as you have seen it, and especially at the beginning of your career, has been almost entirely reactive to problems. And you really believe the healthcare system should be functioning differently, not just reactively. How would you want to change this, and how have you worked to change this in the healthcare industry?
Well, first of all, I think that there are two paths. One, you know, healthcare is a basic human right. Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states very clearly that healthcare is a basic right for all people. And so I have been absolutely an activist to ensure that we do provide that right. When one person has not received healthcare, we have violated the Declaration. And so we do have to continue to drive forward that focus to make sure that it is accessible to all. Second is, I don't think that this is going to be corrected by more innovation, that we have to drive forward, and I talk about this in my book, Collaborative IQ. I think we can learn from other countries. You know, when you look at countries like Italy, Sweden, and Hungary, when you look at the measurements of how we measure healthcare, that's life expectancy, you know, reduction in infant mortality and maternal mortality. There are other countries that spend far less than we do in the United States. And interesting enough, their metrics are far better. And so there has to be a sense of, should we continue to innovate? I think we have innovated far more than what we should. I think it's time to integrate. I think it's time to collaborate. It's time to understand that we have to live a healthier lifestyle. And how do we put preventive measures in? Because we tend to be too reactive. We tend to wait until somebody needs care, and we think that that is the healthcare system. I think we have to be able to manage health and be able to bring, if you will, systems that can empower the consumer. I think we are living in an age today where consumers want to be empowered. They make great decisions in terms of their mortgages on homes. They make great decisions in terms of which cars they are going to select. But we haven't done a great enough job in integrating the tools that can empower consumers. So my, you know, focus these days is first access. I think that we're getting better in terms of the number of uninsured that are moving into the insured roster. And then I think there has got to be not just a focus on engagement. When you're sick, you get engaged. You've got to empower and engage. And that's going to take some time. That's a transformative healthcare system that's going to take years for us to really get it to the point. But I do think we can learn from other countries. And I think that one of the things that you see in other countries is a much more standardization of what care is and also a focus in terms of prevention.
One of your bits of advice, and you have all kinds of great advice for would-be entrepreneurs and leaders and so on. Among your best bits of advice, I think, is that people should not think only about the value of innovation, but that also integration is important, and that in many cases, gifts of integration are maybe even more significant and more helpful than a knack for innovation. Explain why integration, which is something we tend not to talk about very much, in fact, has so much significance, especially in this particular arena.
Well, absolutely. So one of the organizations that I founded in 2011 is an organization by the name of Healthy Villages. It means heal the villages. The reason why I started that organization is because I was reading an article in 2010 that in our lifetime, 1 billion people go to their graves prematurely because they never had access to a healthcare worker. 6 million are children who die each year because they have no access to a healthcare worker. Now, one could say we need to innovate more. we need to educate more doctors and nurses. Well, let me tell you this. You're not going to educate enough doctors and nurses to correct that problem. Case in point, in India, a population of 1.2 billion people, 45% don't have toilets, but 75% have mobile phones. I think that if we start to integrate mobile technology with the villagers, the people that can use that technology to detect, if you will, if someone in the community is high risk for a disease. Case in point, in East Africa, after we launched Healthy Villages, infant mortality was 100 babies per 1,000 births died. We went in there and we partnered with an organization using our technology, but we didn't bring doctors and nurses into the community. We trained the villager. The villagers became part of the solution. Sometimes the hot innovation is right at the center of where the problem is happening. So we educated the community villagers. Just because you are poor does not mean you don't have an intellect. We put the mobile technology in their hands so that they could identify who in the community were expecting a baby and were they at high risk for delivering that baby. And sure enough, the mobile technology with those villagers identified the high-risk pregnant mothers. They then got them into the community health center. Today, babies for 1,000 births die, not 100. And we still have more work to do to get that 30 down to hopefully zero. But you can see we integrated the villagers. We integrated the technology that was there rather than watching the dollars and the time and death by trying to come up with something more. So I believe innovation with integration, and I call it collaboration. How do you collaborate what's out there and innovate? I'm not saying stop innovating. What I'm saying is collaborate and look what's out there. I think in many respects that, you know, I move by some of the most simplest innovation. In Colombia, there is a program that's called the Kangaroo Care. What they have that mothers can serve as an incubator to their baby by putting their babies close to their heart. They can measure the heartbeat. They can give warmth to the baby. And so skin-to-skin contact be just as effective as having an incubator. There is nothing great that you've used out there. That's what integration and collaboration is all about.
Mm. Well, there is much more to be found in this really, really interesting book, which is called Life's Bulldozer Moments, How Adversity Leads to Success in Life and Business. The book is published by Hamilton Books, which is an imprint of Roman and Littlefield. The author, Donato Tramuto. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your interesting book. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Greg.
And here is what is coming up over the next several days of WGTD's Morning Show as we reach exactly 8:58. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be talking theater. First with Jennifer Sassaman from the theater department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, talking about their current play, which is called One Man, Two Governors. Also, we'll talk with Doug Instanis about the current play at the Racine Theater Guild, which is called A Comedy of Tenors. On Thursday, Nan Calvert will be here along with several guests to talk about the upcoming EcoFest. On Friday, Amy Bass, the author of a heartwarming and intriguing book called One Goal, a coach, a team, and the game that brought together brought a divided town together. The town in question, Lewiston, Maine. And the team was the soccer team of the high school, which was made up mostly of Somali refugees. And they were representative of the thousands of Somali refugees who had made their way to Lewiston, Maine. It was something that utterly reshaped the town and also led to some discord and division. And in many respects, it was the tremendous success of the high school soccer team that was so instrumental in bringing this community together. We hear the story on Friday. Next Monday, the 12th, I am looking forward to talking with Dan Gaitan. He was scheduled to be with us yesterday, but a family emergency prevented him from being able to be at the station. But he will join us on Monday to talk about the research that he has done in terms of fraud in the hospice care industry. The research that he has been doing on that over the last several years led him to be featured in an upcoming episode of CNBC's series called American Greed.